You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Delta Quadrant Podcast, part of the Trekmate Family.
You're listening to The Delta Quadrant, a Star Trek Voyager podcast. This is a podcast where we review episodes of Star Trek Voyager in the order in which they were broadcast. Tonight's episode is Hunters. This is Blair from Ontario, Canada.
And this is Matt from Arizona.
And I'm Ben from Arizona.
And this is Melissa from North Dakota.
And this is Gino in Oklahoma.
And we are welcoming back our returning guest, Blair. Blair was on for our worst-case scenario pod, otherwise known as the pod where Gino had connection issues.
I had a few connection problems that evening.
But in any case, welcome back, Blair, to the Delta Quadrant.
Great, thanks. It's great to be back.
For those of listeners who may not have gotten to the worst case scenario pod or may have forgotten, why don't you reintroduce yourself and tell the listeners who you are once again.
Sure. I live in Canada in a town just north of Toronto. I've been a Star Trek fan pretty much almost all my life, as far as back as I can remember. Deep Space Nine is probably my most favorite episode or series, with TNG a close second. So I'm a big fan of collecting the action figures and going to a lot of the conventions. So yeah, and I've been listening to the Delta Quadrant now for a couple of years.
And so I do believe you mentioned right before we started that you're on your way to another convention next week.
Yeah, they have it's called Fan Expo Canada in Toronto, and it has a combination of sci-fi, horror, gaming, so on and so forth. And they have quite a few guests coming: Carl Urban, Zachary Quinto, George Takei, Nichelle Nichols, Ron Perlman, and Jeffrey Combs, I believe, is going to be there again. So, yeah, quite a list of characters that I look forward to seeing again.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I'd love to meet Ron Perlman.
Yeah, I actually started watching one of his other series, Sons of Anarchy, and it's not a bad series, but he looks like an interesting character, that's for sure.
Have you gotten all the way through Sons of Anarchy yet, just to tangent off?
No, I'm only on, I'm starting season 4, so no spoilers. Okay. I'm trying to, I've been pretty hooked so far, so.
Okay, glad you're enjoying it.
I'm also, I think it's pretty cool. I mean, we just got back from VegasCon. I think it's pretty cool, too, that the new Trek people are doing some of the convention circuit now. Carl Urban and Zachary Quinto, like you said. So that should be interesting, for sure.
Yeah, I know they're going to be in high demand, and I think Zachary Quinto is only there on the Saturday. So, I'm a big fan of getting the action figures autographed. So, an $80 a pop, too, Canadian, that is. It's going to dent the wallet, that's for sure.
I will say, though, that having just met Carl Urban, he's a lovely, lovely guy. So you should have good experience there for sure.
Great. Looking forward to it.
But now we're going to continue our review of what I have dubbed the Trilogy of Awesome with the middle chapter called Hunters. So short synopsis for this episode is Voyager receives a message from Starfleet containing letters from the crew's friends and family. This is the 15th episode of Season 4 of Star Trek Voyager, first aired February 11th, 1998. It was written by everybody's favorite writer, especially mine, Jerry Taylor, and it was directed by David Livingston. The guest stars this week include Tiny Ron as the Alpha Hirogen and Roger Morrissey as the Beta Hirogen. Now, Gino, is it you that has the notes this week?
Yep.
Okay, then. Gino, whenever you're ready, take us into Hunters.
Excellent. All right. Well, the episode this week starts off with some garbled radio chatter, and on that, let's go right into a clip.
What happened?
I'm not sure. The transmission just stopped.
Locate the source, see if you can get it back.
Captain, the transmission was sent along the same network of alien relay stations we used to send the Doctor to the Alpha Quadrant.
Starfleet Command must be using them just like we did.
Harry, can you clear the interference from that message?
Yes, ma'am. They said they wouldn't stop until they found a way to get us home.
Nonetheless, we can't assume they've been able to devise a plan this quickly.
Here it is.
This is Starfleet Command to the USS Voyager. If you are receiving this message, please study it carefully. We have information.
That's all we got. It looks like the bulk of the transmission is lodged in one of the relay stations.
Can you tell which one?
It's about 3.8 light years from us, on a heading of 274 Mark 1-3.
Set a course, Tom.
Last time we used one of those stations, the people who built it weren't too happy.
We'll deal with that if we have to, but I'm not going to lose this opportunity. We're going to find out what the rest of that message says.
How fortunate is that, huh? It's 3 light years away. They'll hop right on over to it.
Well, we did see for the last episode that the relay network is extensive in their area. There's a ton of them, and we see the graphic of representing it again. I will say, I'll put this forward right now, we've debated in the past about Janeway's willingness to charge forward, especially in the Scorpion episode that we did. However, I think that, for me at least, her willingness to charge forward and get to the message as quickly as possible, I think is understandable here. I'm in support of it, because who wouldn't want to go chasing after that message after 4 years of nothing?
Sure, right. Yeah.
This was a really exciting opening, I think, for this episode. As we talked about in the last episode, this is the moment where we really get that solid hope of they're going to get home. They finally have some type of contact with home. And so I think to come into the very next episode with this beginning, there were beautiful visuals at the beginning of this episode. You hear that garbled message, but as you hear it, they're showing it kind of floating through the various nebulae and all of, you know, all of space to get to them. And I'm trying to remember the first time that I saw this and being so excited to see where the story was going to go. This was a really exciting opening for me.
Yeah, it's important that those openings catch you early because, you know, that's what keeps you invested. How many times did you guys rewind or leave on the subtitles to see what if you could gather any more extra words out of that message?
Well, actually, I do believe I didn't watch this on DVD, but I have watched this on DVD before, and I think if you turn on the subtitles there, you can get the bits and pieces that the message has.
Yeah, there's nothing extra, unfortunately. I kept going back and forth, and because I was like, hopefully, maybe they left an Easter egg in there for us, but they didn't.
Well, I will say, though, not to spoil things too far ahead, but this garbled message will become very, very important for the season 4 finale when we get there.
Okay, good to know. Well, just after we get that message and start heading to the relay station, we see another ship with Hirogen, who are also listening to the message and set an intercept course for Voyager. The guy who looks to be in charge slaps on some war paint, and we get the opening credits. So it's going to be a good one, guys. We're going to have an encounter here. And have we had a main encounter with the Hirogen yet?
No, we just met them for the first time last week on the view screen. So.
Yes. There's also an error later on that we'll discuss about that very thing.
Right. And if I could, I consider this a compliment. So I give this as a compliment. But to me, this episode felt a lot like a Deep Space Nine episode. They pack a ton of character development and information into this one episode. We get introduced to this new scary guy on the block, the Hirogen, and I was just really impressed all the way through. I got to pull the clips for this episode, and it was so hard to pick because every scene was packed with character development.
You could have almost have had the entire episode just center around the letters from home, and right. and to have the Hirogen, which was kind of reminded me almost like the Predator in their in their trophy room there. I thought, wow, what are we in for? I was pretty excited with seeing them.
I honestly think that bridges the gap between if it were around the letters, this would have been a TNG episode. But because they added that element of danger, I think this was more like DS9.
Two things. One, good call on the Predator, Blair, because I was going to bring that up later if you didn't. Gino, those stupid aliens from Nemesis may have looked like the Predator, but the Hirogen actually are the Predator.
Yeah.
I was going to say the same thing.
You know, the best episodes of Trek are the ones you remember forever. Just putting that out there, listeners.
Second of all,
Daryl makes me slap you from a couple states away.
Well, here's the thing, though. I agree with everyone's assessment so far, Melissa, Blair. What I'm curious to see is Ben knowing that in your analyses of these Star Trek episodes that story comes first before character development, at least for you. And this being an episode centered mostly around character development, I would say, I'm curious to see what your reaction will be. Now, what I'll propose to you is this. Yes, this may not be the most exciting, like, groundbreaking story you've ever seen, but it would make no logical sense for having just established contact with the Alpha Quadrant if this story were never to happen or would have just been brushed over and not really given the acknowledgement that it should, because 4 years is a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And we know from DS9 that a lot's happened since they left, because Voyager gets lost around season 3 after they just meet the Dominion for the first time. So a lot has happened, and to me, it may not be the most exciting. It may not be everything you personally want in a story, Ben, but I'm curious to get your reaction to the fact that I think that this story was, it was important that this story be told, because to gloss over it and not really acknowledge it would have rang false, at least to me.
Well, at the very least to start with here, they are impressive-looking aliens. I'm glad to see a new ship. I'm glad to see a new race. We know we're going to have to deal with them, and we know they're bad guys. So, I mean, the tension, the drama, it's all there. It's all waiting to be plucked. Like Melissa said, it's a great opening.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get this ball rolling, huh?
I just want to add one more thing. I love the Hirogen. I'm just going to say to put that out front. For the first time, I'm excited about a Delta Quadrant enemy since the Vidians. They're the most interesting since the Vidians, I think.
I would agree. So here we are on the bridge. The crew talks about the possibility of Starfleet finding a way to send them home. We get introduced to Season 1 Harry Kim again. And they, in fact, mention the wormhole to the Gamma Quadrant. So they're saying there's got to be something that can get them home.
Oh, Gino, Season 1 Harry Kim, you're so right. You're so right.
He's so right.
Come on, he's so excited to get home. I don't care. Let's get home.
I know. Isn't it just sickening to see? Can I just say?
Oh, God. Captain, do you think there'd be letters for everybody?
You know what's hilarious, Ben, is that at 3 points in the note in this episode in my notes, whenever he doesn't get a letter, I just have the bullet point, no one wants to talk to you, Harry.
He was such a whiner. Oh, that's just brutal.
Not even your parents want to talk to you.
The thing is, yeah, you could just say it's character development, but I prefer to look at this episode as the fact that every character has their own story. So quite often we talk about a show having an A plot, B plot. This show has a plot line for almost every major character on the show. They all have a little story arc that they go through.
We get all our pairings, don't we, Melissa?
We do.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. I'm going to put this up forward. I think, for me personally, I've had my problems with Jerry Taylor in the past, but I do think, for my money up to this point, this is probably my favorite script of hers, only because she's not so fixated on that we have to make Janeway awesome and give her all the screen time. She really just, she does manage to balance out everyone's reactions to getting the letters from home in this episode, which is something that I appreciate, and something that she doesn't normally do. So, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, moving right along, we see the Doctor talk with Seven in Astrometrics. That's where we get our next clip.
Another one.
I beg your pardon.
I've retrieved another word of text. That makes six.
Six words in 58 hours? Wouldn't it be more efficient just to wait until we arrive at the relay station?
This message is important to the captain.
I'm aware of that. In fact, if it weren't for me, this transmission wouldn't have been possible in the first place. I was the one who risked my matrix in order to go to the Alpha Quadrant. If we ever get home, I expect I'll become quite the hero. Emergency medical hologram instrumental in the return of Voyager crew. Has a nice ring to it, don't you think?
On the other hand, it is entirely possible that your program will be deleted and you'll be upgraded to conform to the most recent standards.
Unlikely.
Yeah, there's a little bit of cynicism from Seven there.
No, but that's what I like about Seven, is she just is very blunt and tells it like it is, and I thought that was great.
I love that we get that little cockiness from the Doctor still kind of left over from the last episode.
Well, of course. I mean, we know what the Doctor's personality is up to this point. Why wouldn't he consider himself somewhat of a hero after what he did last week?
Oh, sure.
And I like that they gave the Doctor this little story, because he isn't like the rest of the crew where he's missing something back home. So really, for him, going home means being recognized as a hero. And so I like that he wasn't left out.
And even his own crew can recognize him as a hero for doing that. You know,
yeah.
If it wasn't for him, they wouldn't have got the letters. And it was only one scene, I think, in the entire episode, but I thought it was a great scene.
Well, after this, the ship starts to shake. They're experiencing a gravimetric disturbance. They notice an adrift ship with one occupant, a dead one. Janeway, Seven, and the Doctor examine the pile of latex / dead guy. He's been completely deboned, just like species 5174, according to Seven. Janeway orders the body returned to the ship. And finally, we arrive at the relay station. The station itself is about 100,000 years old, and nobody is aboard. Good thing, I guess. The ship experiences another gravimetric disturbance. Turns out the station is powered by a quantum singularity, much like what else, you guys?
The Romulan ships.
That's right.
So, nothing good ever comes of quantum singularity-powered ships.
Ever.
I could be wrong about this, but weren't the quantum singularities the thing that the Vulcans believed existed, or that T'Pol was trying to argue that they existed, and Archer didn't believe her in
Dark
the...
Dark matter.
No. In the episode Shuttle Pod 1, isn't the microsingularity what cuts through the shuttle and...
I think you're thinking about First Flight, where her and Archer were rolling to go see that nebula. No?
No, I'm thinking in Shuttle Pod 1.
Oh, that's right. Where the Enterprise gets damaged and they got to stop, and then they lose their air in the shuttle because something hits them.
Right, and T'Pol and Archer have this conversation, and Archer's like, you know, microsingularities. You Vulcans would blame the common cold on that if... Because nobody believes that they exist. I think it's microsingularities.
I think you're right.
It's a good thing we review Voyager and not Enterprise. Otherwise, we look like a bunch of dummies.
That's true. It's not our forte. Right. However, I think it's pretty cool that we get some backstory on these relay stations. There's many times in Star Trek where we talk about really ancient races. The booby trap comes to mind. Where that was the episode where Picard gets fascinated with an old ship, and they get Enterprise has, you know, the anomaly weak thing. Anyway, but I like when we delve into the ancient history of this universe. I like when any science fiction delves into ancient history that humans had nothing to be a part of. So I think just that little nugget is a cool part.
Wasn't that also kind of the same thing when Next Generation encountered what turned out to be a library and Data started taking on multiple personalities?
Masks.
Oh, God, the comet.
What's the less said about masks, the better.
What I
think is really cool too is just from my standpoint is finding the deboned alien. Now, what this started me, you know. Of course, the stuff at the beginning reminded me of Predator, but this really reminded me of the beginning of Predator, because I don't know how many of you have seen the movie, but Schwarzenegger and his team get there and they find these special ops guys that are supposed to be like these ultimate badass people, and they're all skinned alive. Like something has skinned them alive and it hung them up to be, to be displayed. And that's kind of what this reminded me of. So that tension that you're mentioning there, Ben, I mean, the Hirogen don't really show up toward the end, but it keeps that stuff going. Like, what could have done this to this alien?
I will say the it's interesting. I don't know if this is a tease or if this is really, you know, important to the Hirogen storyline, but it is a unique thing. We have not seen a race dedicated to the, besides the Borg, a race dedicated to the destruction of others. And so
I'm going to disagree with you there. The Borg are focused on perfection and not as much the destruction of other races. Like, they just leave irrelevant races alone unless they, you know, are a threat. The Hirogen are all about the fight and the honor and everything. I would pin them closer to the Klingons than the Borg.
Well, not just the fight. I mean, I think what this scene does is that, like we said earlier, the most we know about Hirogen is that they're a face on a view screen from last episode. So what this helps to do is establish this sort of hunting culture, because it's not that they don't live for the fight; it's they frame it around they live for the hunt.
Yeah, they love more the hunt.
I think the writers of Star Trek seem to have a really strong negative opinion about hunting in general, because there's the episode Rogue Planet, also in Enterprise, where we have the hunters, and the hunters are presented as a bunch of guys who just sit around and drink beer and shoot stuff, which may not be entirely untrue about hunters. However, you know, I think there's a difference
between doing the hunting creatures, though, and then these people hunting and basically desecrating like sentient species, like, you know.
Right.
And
I'm just saying,
running around the ship with a spear.
I'm just saying, every time hunters are depicted in Star Trek, it's not a positive depiction.
Man in my dreams.
Melissa, Star Trek loves to make straw men, so it's fine.
I know. Yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to point out here, Ben, there is one reason that the ship couldn't get any closer to the station, and do you know why? Gravimetric eddies!
No, but the last time you guys were getting off over this, it was astral eddies, so something different.
Astral, subspace, if it's an eddy, I'm on board.
I'm on board, too. I must admit.
And roll right along. Janeway and Seven start receiving messages in astrometrics, and it's personal letters from home. So Neelix is assigned the personal mail carrier because he needs a job. And Seven has discovered something odd. A latent data stream underneath, which appears to be more text and maps. Janeway and Seven talk about what all this means, and here we get our next clip.
I'm curious, Seven. What do you think about all this? Messages, the possibility of getting home.
It lacks any emotional resonance for me. I've never even been to Earth.
You realize you may have family there.
That had not occurred to me.
You could have cousins, grandparents. There might be more emotional resonance than you think.
Okay, I chose this clip for two reasons. One, I think it is another in what will be a series of strong mother-daughter moments between Janeway and Seven. This is Janeway reaching out to Seven, I think, on a very maternal level. She's getting her to realize that there might be people on Earth that she will care about, and she's asking about how she feels about this. So I really liked that moment because of that. And secondly, I think it's just really great acting on Jeri Ryan's part. She does so well, and the chemistry between Jeri Ryan and Kate Mulgrew is really, really nice.
Yeah, and that's something we've been talking about since she's gone on board. It's much more smooth between those two than Janeway and Kes. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a great scene, especially because we had a little passover from the previous episode. In the same exact room, we had Janeway looking a little sideways at Seven because she didn't really care about protocol, and she's kind of reaching back to her Borg side a little bit more. Now we're seeing her more as a human again. So I love that we're getting some character involvement, a little bit of an evolution here.
Definitely, and again, to just foreshadowing for the future, I like that they're setting this up now, because this is this storyline between Janeway and Seven, and Seven not necessarily being enthusiastic about going back home, is going to play a big part in the season 4 finale.
Wow, this episode is a big jumping off point for other episodes, apparently.
It is indeed. Hey, Blair, so it's been since Worst Case Scenario since we've had you on. That was pre-Seven of Nine. We got to know, overall, so far in your season 4 run of watching Voyager with us, what do you think of Seven so far? Is she a character that you're appreciative being on screen, or what are your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, everyone always, you know, gives her the gears because of the looks. Like, they had to bring, you know, a bombshell on the series, you know, and Kate Mulgrew was very disappointed that they had to bring one on, you know, when in conversations that she's spoken about, I guess. But the character, you know, she's a great-looking lady, of course, but I really love
the character. I just want to stop you right there. I just want to point out, in case whether or not we ever have Kate Mulgrew on the show, that lady is a looker, okay?
Fair enough.
Yeah, well,
please continue. Yes.
Let's go back to 7 and 9 here. I think the character is great. I love the idea of having a Borg on the ship, of the struggle that she's had, you know, of as you said, switching back and forth between, you know, wanting to go back to being Borg, to wanting to be human, to not knowing what she wanted to do, and the loyalties. And I just think she's been a great character so far, and I've thoroughly enjoyed her being on, you know, on since she's come on.
Awesome. And I think you'd agree that, you know, I've said this since the beginning of season 4, if the role was casted wrong, then she would have just been all looks and nothing more. The fact that they got someone who not only looks good but can act and hold her own, I think is what made the difference.
True. And scene specific, this conversation between the two of them, you know, up till now, we've had a lot of Seven. It's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. I'm Borg. You know, I do things efficiently, perfectively, you know, perfectly. And at least relatively compared to you humans, who she kind of looks at as being beneath her in many ways. I get that vibe off her. But here Janeway gets her. She finally, Janeway has brought something to Seven's attention that she had never considered. And that's a big moment, I think. You talk about character, Matt. That's a humanizing moment for 7 of 9. I think it's very well done. I mean, it's a little awkward the way Janeway introduces it. But that's the way that conversation would be introduced in real life. So I got to give a little bit of credit where credit's due.
I think what you're also going to find in just all the pairings, and I'm sure we'll talk about them as we go on, you see a lot of this interaction. Like, these people are being faced with the harsh realities of what they're finding in the letters that, you know, as we're going to see without spoiling it, like, it's a slap in the face for a lot of people. And the interactions and the way the pairings and, you know, Neelix and Tuvok, Paris and Torres, like, I just thought it was really done well. And the Janeway Seven was great as well. Just, again, it was, I think, the first time you saw Seven kind of, as you said, I think, Ben, you know, she just kind of thought, oh, well, she had to actually ponder that. It wasn't irrelevant anymore, so...
That's the wonderful thing, Ben, is what you mentioned right there. What I love about Seven's arc is that, you're right, she starts completely on one pole, and then, like, I think beginning with this episode, you see the compass needle start to turn with her a little bit. You know what I mean? And it just gets further and further away from that Borg nature to where she finally does start embracing her humanity by the end.
Well, moving along, Neelix arrives on the bridge and gives a letter to our favorite character, Chakotay, from the person who recruited him into the Maquis. Why isn't he being tackled right now? Anyway, Harry asks about if he got any mail. Nope, none for Harry. He is sad. Boo.
PDH.
Tuvok is next to receive a letter, and though he's a little busy, Neelix wants him to read it right away, mainly because he's already snuck a peek at some of it. So Tuvok agrees to go ahead and let Neelix read it to him. Tuvok's a grandfather! Yay! After a little bit more, Neelix decides to leave, and Tuvok goes back to work, but not for long, because he's intrigued and sits down and reads the letter himself, which looks like a pretty good scene. I love seeing Tuvok's quarters.
Now, here's the great thing about Tuvok. He is wonderful for a laugh. He can be a great, great, funny character. But in this scene, I think I was really impressed by he can pull on your heartstrings, too. I mean, I love his character. And we see this with the Vulcans all the time. They're not supposed to have any emotions, but quite often they elicit the strongest emotions, I think, in us as viewers watching.
I agree. And well, I love that they point out his age, too. Just another reminder. By the way, he's really old.
Mm-hmm. What's the thing about the Vulcans, though, is that we have to remember, I mean, we see it so often that we just think they don't have emotions. They do have emotions. They just suppress them.
Okay, so we're on Vulcans. I think this scene is the best scene in the entire show. I love Tuvok. I love the fact that I think I said it many times before, or if I haven't and you don't remember, here it is. Tuvok is the best Vulcan in my mind. Now, for all those TOS guys who went, heresy. Yeah, well, you know, I retcon it. I rationalize it because Spock is only half Vulcan. So there you go. However, though, I love Tuvok. I think we'll get some more interesting Vulcan things later on here. But right here, you're absolutely right, Melissa. The way Tim Russ, he doesn't change his face. He doesn't do much. We talk a lot about faces, Janeway's face, the way she can act with her face. It's very impressive. Tuvok, he doesn't get to do that. So how does he do it? You know, it's his body actions. It's the way his body language, I should say. From him showing how he's disappointed, not upset, but disappointed that Neelix read that bit of his first letter. To... The pondering, the contemplation that he does when he sits down in this scene. The body language is superb. He brings it out so well. And I really do enjoy his performance. I enjoy him in this episode.
And his timing is perfect, Ben.
Oh, yeah.
Before you move on, to contrast that with something that's not so good, did it seem a little quickly when Chakotay's handed his letter, he already sees that it's bad news? Like, he's barely got it in his hands, and, like, it says... He has this look on his face like, it's from this person who recruited me into the Maquis, and I have to leave the bridge right now.
Well, you see, you like, read the rest of the script.
See, yeah. That's the thing, is like, did the letter start off with, hey, we're all dead?
No, but so much pressure had been on him, though, on that bridge. I'll cut him a break here. He had everybody staring at him. It's right. Like, oh, you're the first one to get the first letter. Let's live vicariously through you.
No, that's not what I'm criticizing. What I'm criticizing is that he reacts to it too quickly. I mean, maybe it's an editing thing, but it looks like he's handed the letter and then immediately has the bad news look on his face.
Okay, like, but his buddy who sent him the letter is in prison, because if he wasn't in prison, he would be dead.
Well, yeah, so, but do they open with that? Like, hey, I'm in prison.
I bet it does. I bet it opens as this is a communique from such and such prison, because that's how prisoners today, that's how their communications work.
It would be edited, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
It would be.
That's probably true.
Melissa, I'd like to point out what happened last week when you talked about defending Chakotay.
Yeah.
But speaking of body language, Janeway gets a letter and takes it to the ready room, and without a word, we see her, first of all, we see that the pad says it's from Mark, and we see her happily read the letter as the smile fades away. And it's not just a smile, not smile anymore. You can tell from the look on her face, it's bad news.
So, see, and this is contrast to what you said about Tuvok. I mean, he doesn't do a lot with facial expression now. With Kate Mulgrew reading this letter, I'm so glad you pointed this out because I love her, just watching her face as she's reading the contents of the letter. It's great.
Beautiful lady and a great actress. Come on.
Absolutely. I was going to say, Gino, to build on the beautifulness that's been going on here that Blair, you know, you had to tell us about. She is actually, I had this thought watching this episode. She is the most beautiful I've seen her yet. Now, I don't want to be taken sexist because she is who she is no matter what, but something about her hair or I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just this episode and the material that she's given. She has an extra something about her throughout the entire episode.
I think throughout season four, actually, since she's gotten this hair, I think maybe it had something to do with her age combined with her level of fitness at the time, but she is looking great.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
Well, she also has an added vulnerability in this episode because we're seeing her experience some serious devastation. We're seeing some hopes of hers get crushed, and she has to choose a new direction. She has to figure out how she's going to deal with this. And I think that there's a beauty in that vulnerability as well.
I was just going to say, it kind of reminded me, I know it's a little different, but from the movie Castaway, when, you know, Tom Hanks, all he did was pine for his wife all that time on the island. And then when he finally had that opportunity to go home, it was so devastating. And yeah, this is a little different because realistically, she probably thought she would never see him again, but to know he's moved on and is married and, you know, that would be such a slap in the face. And
I love that you point out Castaway, not just because I love that movie, but because we kind of get the same type of things here. A lot of acting with no speaking and the same kind of theme with what I would say is my favorite Beatles line, life goes on within you and without you. And that's, I mean, incredibly poignant for this episode.
The thing that I love about this scene in particular, too, is that I'm so glad that this subplot with Janeway being engaged, because she was engaged before Voyager was lost. This is her fiancé. I'm so glad that they close this out because this is something that has to be addressed. There needs to be an answer to what happened, and I'm glad that, you know, it may not take a whole lot of time in the episode, but I'm glad that it seems they addressed it, and the reaction from Janeway is genuine.
It's good. I wonder if that's something that they thought of making a bigger deal in the start and decided to drop, and later on decided if we're going to give her any sort of romantic involvement, we first need to get rid of the other guy. And in doing so, we can give her a great moment like what she's had just here.
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying, but and realistically, this is if this were to happen in real life, this is probably what would happen.
You think
your fiance is dead, you're going to move on. 3 years Absolutely. Is a long time.
And I can just totally understand everything that she goes through in this episode because, you know, besides being the captain, she also has to be the one who constantly holds out hope for everyone. And so for her, this was a big part of that package. This was a big part of what it was she was hell-bent on getting home for. And so she has to reevaluate and refocus. And she even admits that at the end of this episode, that she was letting this connection keep her from living in the moment in a certain way. And so she has to learn how to live without that now.
Oh, yeah. And we'll get there in a moment. But first, let's have a little talk between Chakotay and Torres in engineering.
Something terrible has happened. I read that letter for an hour before I could accept it. Now I have to tell everyone else, and I'm not sure how to do it. It's over, B'Elanna. There are no more Maquis.
What are you saying? There are thousands of us.
All wiped out. It seems the Cardassians have an ally. A species from the Gamma Quadrant who supplied them with ships and weapons.
No.
B'Elanna.
Don't! You don't try to console me. I don't want to be comforted. Those were our friends. Good people willing to put their lives on the line for something they believed in. And now you're telling me that they are gone. that they are slaughtered.
Those are the risks we all took. We knew where it could lead.
It's not right, and you know it. I will make someone pay. I swear I will. If we ever get back.
If they get back, B'Elanna Torres is kicking some Jem'Hadar butt.
Melissa, I am so glad you included this scene because Tuvok may be the highlight for you, and I thought that was really good. This is my favorite reaction to the news back home scene, mainly because to Blaze of Glory from DS9, where the destruction of the Maquis is addressed, is one of my favorite episodes of that series. But, you know, this is such a big part of what happened in the Alpha Quadrant that this it needs to be addressed, especially since half this crew is Maquis. And, you know, I'm glad we get the reactions of the two senior-most Maquis officers. And I'm really happy. Again, like you were saying, Gino, I didn't realize until this point, but this episode is a jumping-off point for a lot of different plots.
I'm telling you, this episode is the November 5th, 1955 of Star Trek.
But this episode, you know, B'Elanna's reaction to the news of the Maquis being slaughtered is going to spurn that great season 5 episode Extreme Risk when we get to it.
Yeah.
Because we'll find out when we get to that episode that ever since she gets the news here that she goes on those, you know, wild holodeck adventures trying to hurt herself.
Oh, yeah.
And I think also what I loved about this and the scenes that we have between B'Elanna and Tom Paris, on one level, everybody wants to get home. But I love the fact that they point out that there are some people on this ship who have a good reason to not want to get home. And even beyond that, the fact that they got lost out in the middle of nowhere was an opportunity for them to rebuild their lives or to start new lives and have a family for the first time. And you would have to think that for these people who are in the Maquis, assuming that they're happy and they've become members of the crew at this point, this is probably the first stability that they've had in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I just like the fact that the show is addressing that as well.
Yeah, and Melissa, it all is pointed out in that first line between Chakotay and Torres where he asks her, did you get a letter? And she says, I'm not expecting any. You know, it shows what their mentality is. Right from that, just that one line, it shows what all those people's mentality is. And yeah, I know for those people out there who want to see more Maquis, we got the two senior officers. You know, we have to just assume that they represent the whole. And this is how they would all feel. And you can imagine that being the case. You know, that Chakotay being their leader would be so heartbroken that he had to tell everybody who he knew were not going to get communique. He knew none of them, and none of them expected these letters. He knew that he had to go and tell each and every single one of them. Couldn't hold a meeting, it wouldn't be right. He'd have to tell them individually one at a time, all of our friends are dead. All the people you've known and loved and fought with and died for and the cause that you've been so interested in is gone. And I wish these shows could be a little bit more in-depth on those types of storylines. I understand why they're not. But I think we get some... I'm glad they did not forget to include it. Because this episode would have been hollow without this scene.
It would have been false, because if people are watching DS9 at the same time, which you can't always assume, but if they are, the destruction of the Maquis is a big plot point in that series. And for them, and like I said, for knowing that half this crew is Maquis, it would have been so wrong to not just pretend like we never addressed this.
This is a big issue that Starfleet has been experiencing, and just because they're in the Delta Quadrant doesn't mean they're immune to it.
And to speak to Melissa's point, this may sound harsh, but I'll put it out there to you guys. With people like Paris and the Maquis who are on Voyager, maybe getting lost in the Delta Quadrant was a good thing for them.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree with you. It could be very well the best thing that ever happened to them.
And because, you know, Paris gets this better life that we'll talk about later, but, you know, realistically, if they hadn't got lost, Chakotay and B'Elanna would probably be dead right now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, whether or not the Maquis members knew that their fight was going south or not, they're displaced from all of this. This has kind of happened in the world of evolution. Let's say different types of animals were brought over by earlier settlers to other countries and evolved to their natural surroundings versus the animals from those other countries, which is why you can see different breeds of, say, dog or domesticated animal that are much differently mannered or even colored differently than ones in their original countries. It's kind of the same thing. You've got these people who are completely away from their source of underground fight, and I don't know. I mean, they're not exactly Starfleet, but they're completely missed by the bigger fight that they were fighting.
So when it comes to the Maquis on Voyager, you know, I know DS9 has obviously a huge part of the Maquis story, but we did get introduced to them in TNG. So I think for the people who went from TNG to Voyager, you have enough of a backstory and understanding of who the Maquis is. There is Ensign Ro, of course, who was part of it. She had a nice story arc there. There was also there were also other things, you know, to sympathize with or empathize with about the Maquis just from TNG. And I'm glad that, you know, Voyager may not need to or have done such a big storyline, but I'm glad to see it done, and I'm glad to see the way that, you know, they integrate other crew members into those, you know, Maquis members. That's, you know, between Kim and Torres, while that relationship might not be the strongest, Kim is like the perfect Starfleet cadet, and Torres is anything but. So I love the fact that we do get in this episode all these scenes between these characters, and the pairings are there, the stories are there, and the development, like Melissa said, is there too.
I really love that this is TV and not theater, just for the fact that Roxanne Dawson is pregnant. And they get to shoot her from shoulders up, and that's all they have to do.
I did want to say, I was so worried about her, for her. She was like, I was like, calm down, Roxanne. Think of the baby right now. No miscarriages, please. I'm glad she made it.
You have to picture, though, too, right now she's doing those holodeck exercises where she's hurting herself and she's pregnant.
Yeah. Well, let's keep going. At this point, Harry meets with Tom in the mess hall, and he's so excited about letters, but Tom is really more concerned about the food that he's eating. Neelix arrives with letters, and once again, Harry is left out. He's getting a little depressed. Well, Seven goes and speaks with Janeway in the ready room. They need to get the messages out ASAP, as they're starting to degrade. And Janeway's kind of looking pensive at this point. We still don't know what her letter was about, but something important happened to her. Well, Harry goes into Astrometrics to find Torres taking over for Seven. She calls him out about his super awesome crush on Seven, but that's not what he came down for. He's looking to see if there's a letter for him. Nothing yet, but Torres reassures him that he'll get one, and to be patient, little slugger. Just gotta wait, buddy. It's okay.
Right. And this is the scene I was talking about, though, between Kim and Torres. I'm really glad that Torres is staying true to herself and taking out her frustrations on Kim. And I'm glad that he's taking it like a good whipping boy does. She makes fun of him, she gives him, you know, all that jazz and whatnot. And I'm glad that they reinforced the friendship by the end of it. I think that's very important.
I just found they kept going back to that whole Ensign Kim is a young, you know, Starfleet cadet type card all the time. Like, the guy's a man. And, you know, there's people on the ship that have their kids at home, you know, and that they'll never see again. Or, you know, he's a grown man. He's already attended the academy. You know, if I was in the mess hall and I was sitting there and Harry's whining that he didn't get one, I'd just be ready to pound him one. You know what? I didn't get one either. Yeah. Suck it up, sunshine. You know?
Exactly.
Okay, but, Blair. Yeah. I'm with you on this, by the way. Hold on. Let me explain myself. I guess I didn't. I'm glad for this that they had this scene because it's good for Torres. It reinforces the strengths of her character. Kim here, though, I am actually right with you, though. Why is he acting like this? He, like you say, he's a grown-up. Why is he crying about his parents? I don't want to get on too much of a soapbox rant, but it makes no sense. It really doesn't. You're absolutely right. It makes no sense why he would act like this.
Again, they're writing him like a teenager. They're writing Kim to be about 16 years old, and it just doesn't work with an adult male.
Yeah, because he's not 16. That's the problem.
Right.
And he's pining for his parents' approval and communication. I mean, like, wouldn't he rather have his friends talk to him? I mean, not that his parents don't mean something to him, but...
What about Libby, or, you know, where was
her
letter?
Libby, yeah, she was, forget her, but also, too, at the beginning of the episode, doesn't he say something about, like, at least I'm just glad my parents know I'm alive, and then all of a sudden that's not good enough, he needs an actual letter for them.
You know, in many ways, they do this to Kim, they do this to him because in some ways, like, just like Chakotay, they decided that these two guys, you know, these guys are what drive, you know, continue the plot mechanisms, and for Kim, the plot mechanism is for Torres and for Perez. Torres has a lot to, you know, deal with in this episode, and we see her deal with it by scapegoating on Kim. We see Paris deal with it by being a polar opposite to Kim. You know, so we get a lot from Paris and Taurus's characters about what they're feeling, about what they're going through in life. And yes, we get the same, to steal a word from Matt, rote line from Kim over and over and over again. I wish I was home. I wish, you know, I hope my parents love me. It's hollow, like you guys all say, but it's they do it because it adds to the other characters.
And I did really enjoy that scene between Kim and Paris. It ended with Kim's line, "I'm not you." Well, I'm not you. You know, because Paris is basically telling him, "I don't want to get a letter. You know, I don't care. I'm way more interested in what Neelix is serving today." And I like that they, like Ben mentioned, I like that they pair Kim up both with Torres and Paris, because it also reinforces why those two work so well in a relationship, because they understand each other really well at that level.
I would agree with that. And on Ben's point about the character, about your plot devices here, Kim has been used before in a couple different roles. They've been trying to figure out what he does best. And I've said before that in a TV show, you have to use your characters as chess pieces. So you only get one main motivation from them per episode, per se. And they've decided to go back on what Harry Kim's main motivation has been for a little while, back to, like I joked before, season one Harry Kim. And I don't know if that has to do with the writing, with the producers saying, oh, remember, Harry Kim's big deal was wanting to get back. So that could be a lot of things going toward it. I don't know if that has to do with his character or the poor writing, but we feel like we're taking a step backwards with Kim.
I do agree with all the criticisms about the way Kim is written, but I will second Ben's opinion in the fact that I like what the scene with Torres does for Torres. And yeah. The only way it could have been made better, in my opinion, I think it's superb as it is, but what could have made it more interesting is that you remember how Kim and Torres had that whole "Hey Starfleet, hey Marquis" thing going. If he would have said something like, you know, after she says, you know, "Don't worry about the letter, you'll get one," and if he had just said, "Thanks, Marquis," hearing the word Marquis, just seeing her facial reaction to it, could have been really interesting.
It would have required him to have the ability to pull off that scene. Just saying.
I know, but I'm not necessarily looking for her to like spill her guts out to him. But as he's exiting, he could have turned around and said, "Thanks, Maquis." And
I know, it would require him to deliver that line, him being Mr. Wong.
But you know what I mean? It could have been interesting if it had
worked. I agree with you. It would have been very good. Very good.
Yes, and just like the delivery company at the start of Castaway, he didn't deliver. But 7 Tuvok head in. Is this a Type 9 shuttle that they're using?
I don't know, but it was FedEx in Castaway.
Okay, good. I didn't want to name any names. I don't want to lose any endorsements if we ever decide to get any. Yes, but 7 and Tuvok head to the station in a shuttle. They talk about protocol regarding the number of crewmen on an away mission. 7 thinks she still isn't fully trusted, but Tuvok says she shouldn't be insulted. They fire a polaron pulse at the station, and then Tuvok asks if the captain's opinion is important to 7. She says it appears important to everyone. Well, the shuttle's scanned by a subnucleonic beam. They require a directional beacon to be directed back to Voyager. They have no communications, warp, or weapons. And a ship is approaching. It's the Hirogen. The shuttle's being fired upon and won't hold out for long. They try to get the ship caught in the gravitational eddies, where they're caught in a tractor beam. The shuttle's shot with something, and 7 and Tuvok fall unconscious. Dun, dun, dun.
So quick adjustment to your notes there, Gino. The audience knows it's the Hirogen. However, Tuvok says that alien ship approaching rapidly from behind. He did not name them.
Oh,
just
yes.
Just want to throw it out there. Not to correct you, but just to build some momentum for me later.
It's the same ship we saw at the start of the show.
No, absolutely. No, you're right. The audience knows all about it. Yes, you're right. Yes.
I know what you're going for, Ben. When we get there, I think there's a way that they can get around it, and I'll try.
Okay, we'll have that debate then. Okay, good. I'm glad you know what I mean.
What I will say, though, Gino, just to set up a little bit, the reason they're going in the shuttle is because the rest of the message is lodged in that relay station, and they can't take Voyager closer, but they think they can make a shuttle get close enough to get the rest of the message. I like the stuff between 7 and Tuvok. I think we've said in the past that pairing is particularly strong, because you have two people who are stoic and think in very, very, you could say mechanical terms, but very, very to the point, no BS sort of thing. And that's what I like most about their interaction here.
I do like it. I still think I like their interaction better in Year of Hell.
Yes, I agree. They were, you know, the circumstances that they were going in Year of Hell were much more dire, and that can make for more interesting right. things.
And plus, this happened. That didn't.
Right, exactly.
Well, B'Elanna Torres calls to the bridge. She's got news for Tom.
I don't know exactly why, but the more everybody gets excited about these letters from home, the more I don't want any part of it. Maybe because what I have on Voyager is so much better than anything I ever had back there. I just don't want the reminder.
You're not the same person you were 4 years ago. What makes you think he is?
Now, what she's talking about there is the fact that Tom's letter is coming in from his father, Owen Paris. And the way he's kind of been since the start of the show is that he and his father didn't always have the best relationship. And he's been hitting on this point again and again throughout this episode. Matt's shaking his head like he disagrees with me. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I'm agreeing with you. Like, they haven't had the best relationship. That was a shaking head in agreement.
All right.
What I do love about this scene in particular, though, is B'Elanna's reaction, because, Melissa, we were saying, I know why Tom Paris acts the way he does, because he likes his life better on Voyager, and I can't blame him, because if he wasn't on Voyager, he probably wouldn't have gotten his second chance. But in a way, I mean, I understand B'Elanna for getting angry at this point, because, you know, he's getting a letter from his loved one. She's kind of like, her reaction is, you know where all my loved ones are right now? They're all dead.
They're dead. So you've got daddy issues. Come on.
So, you know, I understand why Paris acts the way he does, but I think Torres, I sometimes criticize Torres for getting angry too quickly, but here I feel it's completely justified. I mean, here he's getting some potentially good news, and all the news that she's getting is that everybody she knew back home is dead.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think if any part of Torres is showing through right here, it's her human side, but, you know, her Klingon side is helping out that rage a little bit, but she's, like you said, completely justified in feeling the way she's feeling here.
That's why I love that line. She says, like, forgive me if I don't feel so sorry for you. You know?
I don't know that I completely agree with you, though, because I think it's in a sense, it's unfair for Torres to weigh her experiences and her feelings against his and saying, well, basically, mine is more important, so you shouldn't have the right to feel bad about what you're feeling bad about. And that's kind of what she comes back with. And I think, I don't know. I don't know that she was entirely justified in doing that to him. I think everyone was dealing with something, and she was so overwhelmed by what she was dealing with that she couldn't feel sympathy for what he was going through at the time. But that doesn't negate what he was going through.
I think it's that she wants people to wear their emotions on her sleeve just like she does.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, throughout this entire episode, is no big deal. I don't want a letter. I don't care what they have to say until they had this moment right here in Astrometrics where he's like, you know, I care. It hurts, and I don't want to know what's going on because it all hurts. And she is saying, why haven't you been saying this in the first place? Why aren't you being honest with yourself like I am?
Right.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
I think what you're seeing with a lot of characters, sorry, Ben, is You know, at times like this, almost everyone that gets the letter, what's the first thing they do? They leave the room. They go read it by themselves. I think you see a lot of these characters are into, whether it's Harry, whether it's Tom, Chakotay, Abe, everyone wants to deal with it themselves, and they're only concerned about themselves in that moment. And I think you see a lot of that, you know, they have to share the misery or take the misery and just keep it on their own shoulders and not share it. And I think you see that quite a bit in the episodes, and everyone has to be reminded that, you know, you aren't just, there are other people out there. There are other people that are being affected by this, and you mm-hmm. have to help out and share those thoughts and be there for the other person and stop just thinking about yourself.
Hey, Blair, why do you always got to make such great points, man? That is excellent. I didn't thought about that whatsoever, that you're right. Every single other person had to get off themselves, and the one character pairings, since we've been talking about pairings this whole time, that are together and that need to deal with it together are Tom and B'Elanna.
Mm-hmm.
That's well done. And kudos to him because it's. I really enjoy this resolution that they come to. You know, you could say, oh, it's a Full House 30-minute, we all got to be better by the end of it. But that's not how that works. Mm-mm. If you don't get over it immediately between each other, you know, there are grudges held. There are problems that get buried. It's best to deal with it right in the moment. And I'm so glad that they represent that correctly here. They represent a couple who, you know, are truly in love with each other, that truly understand each other, that immediately forgive each other and take the blame on themselves before putting it on the other. I think that's a wonderfully done relationship. Whether it's quick or not, it's very realistic and it's very real, and I appreciate it.
To your point, Ben, I mean, the thing I like about it is that you're right, that's life. You know what I mean? This is how you react in a real life situation. And I think that, you know, in the follow-ups to these, I'm glad to see that, you know, especially with B'Elanna, this is not the end of this for her. I mean, she may be able to deal with the initial anger at this point, but stuff like the kind of news that she got in particular is something that's going to stay with her for a long time, as it would, I think, if you're grieving, you know? Yeah. And I really like that. And to Blair's point, I mean, maybe the going on with that theme of first isolating yourself to read this news and then coming back to those pairings, maybe that's why at the very end of this episode the party thrown by Neelix is a good idea, because it'll allow those characters to get together to be with what they consider their family now and to try to work through everything that they just learned about in the past couple of days or however long this episode takes.
Well, this is really everyone's past coming back to haunt them in this episode. And you can imagine being in a difficult situation with a group of people that you are thrown together with. You bond on a certain level because you're all dealing with this same situation and you're all stuck with each other. And so I think part of the reason why they all go their separate ways to read their letters is because this is their past that is individual to each of them. It might not be something that they've brought into that relationship that they're building with each other. So it is interesting and it is powerful to see some of them bring that past into their current relationship and help each other to deal with it in all of these different stories.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we get some throwbacks a little bit more here and a reminder that Janeway's a scientist as Chakotay enters the ready room and reports that Seven and Tuvok were successful. With Janeway's been looking at the station and realizes it's been generating as much energy in a minute as a star puts off in a year. She wants to hang around and learn more about it, which nobody will probably object to. And Chakotay asks about her letter.
You haven't mentioned your letter. Who was it from?
It was from Mark, the man I was engaged to. He told me about the litter of puppies my dog had, how he found homes for them, how devastated he was when Voyager was lost. How he held out hopes we were alive longer than most people did, until he realized that he was clinging to a fantasy. So he began living his life again, meeting people, letting go of the past. About 4 months ago, he married a woman who works with him. He's very happy.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I knew he'd eventually move on with his life. But there was such a finality to that letter.
I love that line.
I know. And the thing that I respect about Janeway in this scene is that they don't play her as naive. She has the line, I knew that this was probably coming. Because realistically, that's probably what would happen. But the thing that she communicates is that that still doesn't mean it doesn't hurt.
Right. She's losing the man, the love of her life, we can presume, because they were engaged. She's losing him all over again in this experience. In one way, she lost him when they got stuck there. But now she's really losing him. Thus the line about the letter having such a sense of finality for her. I can't imagine what kind of enormous strength it must take for her to be dealing with that on one level and to still be able to do her job as the captain of that ship and lead everyone and still be strong for everyone. That's an enormous load for anyone to bear.
This kind of reminds me of Picard in Generations, just after he's gotten the bad news about the fire. He's trying to be strong, but...
Yeah. So since when, though, is Janeway an archaeologist? I thought that was Chakotay's role. And speaking of, I'm just saying, anyway, you can't defend it. Speaking of that, more importantly to that probably has some more meaning to it. Why is Chakotay so nosy? It's none of his business. He left the bridge and did not share his letter with the people in that moment in time until he was obligated to and responsible to do so. Why is he pushing his agenda on Janeway? It's so obvious and so, to me, it's in some ways repugnant that he is trying to weasel his way into her heart is what the way they're writing this to be. Oh, take advantage of the fact that she's vulnerable, like you said, Melissa, and he's sweet-talking her. It's off-putting. It makes me just dislike him.
I didn't see it that way at all. I saw it as a tender friendship between the two of them, that he was able to come in and that she was able to share this with him. And I remember the first time I watched this episode thinking that maybe those two finally had a chance to get together after this.
And
I thought that's the direction it was going in.
Yeah, and to me, I was dreading the fact that they would be so naive to put these two together. And I'm like, please, for God's sakes, do not do that. That would just be, I wouldn't be able to handle it. It should never happen. It shouldn't happen. It would be so antithetical to her character. She would never cross those boundaries. Picard never would, and she never would either. And so to me, Chakotay trying to like be that suave dude, the way he tries to execute it as, you know, his delivery, I can't handle it. It's a huge negative aspect of this episode to me. Matt, you asked me about characters, and, you know, as pairings go, this is the failure of the episode.
If I could just come down the middle on this. Melissa, I kind of felt the way you did at the beginning, but Ben, as you were talking about the scene and framing it the way you did, I now see your point. I will say this much. If they wanted to explore a Janeway-Chakotay relationship, the time for it is way past. Way, way past. They should have done it way back when in season 2 in that one episode where they're stranded on the thing. In that episode, they told us this relationship is not going to happen. So, you know, the time for that is over. And I understand that people held out hope for it, but I'm with Ben. If they had done it at this point, the magic moment has passed.
I agree. I think this type of relationship was done much better with Picard and Crusher.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they set that up at the beginning, you know.
But I think the tone of their relationship that they set at the end of this episode is not a romantic one. It's one of friendship, and I think that it's one that absolutely has to exist between those two as the captain and the first officer. They have to be friends, I think, in a way that she's not friends with the rest of the crew. He has to be on her side, and he should be someone that she can confide in.
I disagree.
Of anyone else on the ship. I think.
What about Tuvok? Why can't she confide in Tuvok? That's her best friend on the ship. That's the person that she knows. He would never, and she could confide in him because he would, you know, being his character is logical. You know, she's so emotional. He's a great counterpoint to her character.
That might be the exact reason, though, why she wouldn't confide in Tuvok about this particular matter.
Why? Because they're really good friends, and he would understand her?
No, because he's a Vulcan. Because he might not understand this.
I think that's why Kirk always confided in Spock, because he would bring the romantic down back to Earth. Mm-hmm. I think that her needing to rely on her first officer is Starfleet. And I think behind all of it, the reason Chakotay is first officer is so that he will make sure the Maquis crew does not revolt, when in all reality, a first officer should have been somebody else. But relying on them, yes. Agreeing with them completely, no. Riker's purpose throughout the entire thing was to say, I don't think that order you gave is the right one to do, or yes, I agree, let's do it that way. But I think the first officer is more of a sounding board for ideas rather than your captain being a dictator on a ship.
And he's also the one who's supposed to check the captain from time to time. If they have this lovey-dovey relationship, how are we supposed to ever believe anything he says is objective?
That's exactly it.
Yeah, you're right, honey. Let's go ahead and do that.
Okay.
And don't try to defend the Melissa, because it was only like 4 episodes ago that she turned ties and became the Dark Melissa, Mirror Melissa. Please, let's just go with that.
And you know what, Ben, you're absolutely right, because there's no way that if they were in this lovey-dovey relationship that this command structure that she's been so adamant about maintaining could ever stay the way she wants it to stay. Yeah. It would become too complicated and too...
No, I think you're wrong, because if Chakotay really wants her to sincerely listen to what he has to say, he's going to have more influence over her as her friend than he is as her first officer.
Melissa, Tuvok is already her friend, and he can't convince her of anything anyway. She's so single-minded. We've established that in the past. There's no way Chakotay is going to break through.
That's
but
right.
If there's something we've also established on this ship over the last 4 years, it's that they're not the same as any other Starfleet ship. They are not just a crew. They are a family.
True.
And they have developing relationships with each other. So I think it's inappropriate for Chakotay to stay just her first officer and not become her friend. And I think this is a moment of vulnerability for her when he has the opportunity to further their friendship. I'm not saying that it has to be a romantic relationship, but it should be a friendship. It should be a close friendship.
I think there's a difference between friendship and good working relationship, though.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
I would be hesitant of, you know, friends tend to not want to hurt each other's feelings. And sometimes there's going to be, especially in a situation like this, there's going to be a lot of tough decisions. And I would hate to see Chakotay be afraid to hurt her feelings as a friend versus hurt her feelings as a first officer / working relationship.
Boom. You know, Nailed it.
That's just my thoughts. You know, it's just you're right. This is a different circumstance. They have to see it as a family, and but there still has to be. I feel you can still have a good relationship, but not be friends, I guess.
Am
I making myself? I don't know.
Yeah,
if I'm saying
I just don't think that there's room for that kind of professional detachment on this ship. There just isn't. Not given the circumstances. There's just no way for them to truly believe that about each other when they really are all they have possibly for the next 70 years. There's just no way for that to happen.
Well, let me just.
I would agree with you before this episode and frankly the last one, but the fact that we've just gotten such a contact, we can talk with Starfleet in almost real time now. So home seems closer than it ever has before. You know, they're already talking at the start of the episode. Maybe they have technology that'll get us home now. You know, it's only a matter of time. Because we can talk now, it's not just the engineers and scientists that are on Voyager. It's all of Starfleet is working to get them home. Let's kind of forget that there's a war going on with the Dominion right now. But regardless, let's not continue the let's all pick on Melissa episode and go on with Hunters.
Before we move on, I just want to say I think I speak for me and Gino and Ben was saying thank God that didn't happen.
Yes. Well, Kim calls them to the bridge. They've picked up an automated distress signal from the shuttle. Nobody is on board. Up next, we see the inside of the Hirogen ship. Well, we see a room with nets with bones in them and panning over to walls that appear to have weapons hanging from them. Does it look like weapons to you guys?
A little bit.
Okay. Well, finally, we see Tuvok and Seven on the floor with pretty cool straps with grommets on them. I would say that's pretty cool combat gear, or, you know, restraints, whatever. And a Hirogen approaches them, calling them pathetic prey. He wants to know why they're using the Hirogen modules. And Tuvok says that if they let him go, there'll be no harm.
Release us now and you'll be safe. Otherwise, we will destroy you.
Pitiful relics. They are the first of their kind. I will be envied. I've located their ship. It's 4,000 Ketrix from the module. We'll be there within the hour. Go to stalking mode. Why do you hesitate? The rest of the group is on its way. I wanted to claim this prey for myself.
We may not be able to take them alone. We need the strength of the others.
I won't share prey with the others. These two must be the only relics. Prepare them!
Now, when Melissa pulled the clip, she labeled this one Hirogen culture, so I feel like she and you guys might have something to say about how the Hirogens act. Am I right?
You're right, Gino. I thought this clip said a great deal about who the Hirogen are as a people.
Is it Hirogen? Hirogens? Should we pluralize it without the S? Kind of like
No, it's the Hirogen, yeah. Just that is the singular and plural.
I just sound dumb. Okay. The Hirogen. Go on, Melissa.
So, for example, obviously they're a hunting culture. But also we find out that they're very competitive. You know, we know that he wants to have the only relic. He calls them relics. So they're not even seeing their prey as persons. They're just seeing them as potential things to be hung on the wall.
Trophies,
right. They're competitive with each other. We see that there's some sort of hierarchy that exists between them. There's kind of the alpha and the beta male on the ship. I think it says a lot about them as a people, just these little flashes that we get about them in this episode.
They are also gigantic.
They're huge. And yeah. By the way, Melissa, you asked me, or someone asked me last week, if that Hirogen that was played by Tiny Ron, who is also Zek's bodyguard in DS9, the guy who never talks, if he would show up again. And this is the same Hirogen. This is Tiny Ron again.
Yep. Now, does anybody know, in shooting that scene, were Tim Russ and Jerry Ryan, were they on their knees or what?
They had to
show
the
height.
I believe they the two actors are over 7 feet or close to 7 feet tall. Plus, they had, from what I read, they had lifters in their boots or whatever to make them appear that much taller. I thought at first maybe it was like camera optics to make them look so short, but no, they were naturally that tall from what I understand.
And it's important that they show them next to Tuvok and Seven, because both of those two, they're very tall. And seeing these Hirogen next to them, just towering over them, you need that little bit of scale, because whenever it shows them by themselves, they like look squatty and wide.
I think there is a bit of camera play going on here just to accentuate the differences. However, when the Hirogen grabs Seven of Nine's neck, he grabs her, you know, to do whatever he does. His hand is gigantic. I mean, now granted, it's obviously a huge glove. There's got to be a bit of prosthetic. I mean, I don't know, a bit more mass to his hand than what is normally there. But he also grabbed her to the side. If you look at it, like, it's his whole hand from his wrist to his fingers that cover her neck. So, I mean, I think there was some camera stuff going on there. However, you're right, Blair. These guys are, when there are multiple shots that show them side by side, and no amount of camera play could give us the kind of scale that we get. These guys are big dudes.
And the set was built for their height, which is why when we see them alone, they don't look giant, because you'd expect a giant person to tower over their surroundings, but everything looks normal for them.
And we also know from watching DS9 that Tiny Ron is big anyway.
Yeah. True. Mm-hmm. Also, okay, so we didn't really, you know, Gino, Astro, anybody here. The controls of the ship, it was kind of unique to see a rod system.
Knobs? What are they doing there?
I was very curious about the, I mean, these are the things that build up an alien race, in my mind, these little mysteries, these little hints, these visual hints about what they do that's not explained at all, but makes me wonder.
That's Star Trek for you.
It is. Very Trekkie.
On Voyager, they've picked up the Hirogen ship. So they hail the Hirogen and the Alpha Hirogen. We don't ever get what he's called, aside from the fact that he's got the white war paint on his head. We can't really tell him apart from the other guys. But he tells them to leave now and refuses to give Tuvok and Seven back, or as he calls, his relics. More Hirogen ships are on the way. Now, Janeway seems to think they'll be able to use the quantum singularity from the station to their advantage. She orders a small warp field around the ship, and then has a level 8 anti-Thoron burst ready to fire at the station and the thrusters at reverse. The Hirogen ship starts to shake, and Tuvok makes a break for it, though the Hirogen throws him around like a rag doll. I mean, Tuvok is tough. But, of course, as we've seen before in episodes when Tuvok's, like, fighting guys on the top of a space elevator, he's not as strong as most Vulcans.
No, but this is again why they had to hire big actors, is because when he's getting tossed around like a rag doll, you need to believe it. If you don't believe it, then it comes off as phony baloney and it takes you right out of the episode.
Well, the Hirogen start to fire on Voyager and don't stop, even though Janeway warns about the danger of the station. The station itself folds in on itself and creates a gravity well. Voyager pulls the ship with Seven and Tuvok with a tractor beam and transports them in after a little bit of work. Voyager's being pulled into the hole itself, so they transfer all available power to the engines, shut down life support, and open the antimatter injectors to 120%, even though Harry Kim protests a little bit, but whatever. They're free, and Janeway heads to Astrometrics. The network has been deactivated.
Can I just say, can we make it an unofficial rule for these Starfleet people? Just don't F with quantum singularities, please, ever.
Okay, so the line I love in this whole action sequence, this is like the last 10 minutes of the episode, it's pretty much a roller coaster. Like you said, you know, Kim goes, or Janeway says, open the injectors to 120%, 120%. Kim goes, Captain, that could reach the core. She's like, just do it.
Just
it was so
do
great.
It.
It was so great. She says
what she says too is that'll breach the core. So if we stay here, it'll breach anyway. So just do it.
I stood up and started. Yeah, that's right, girl.
So that's what I liked about it, is that Janeway basically just said, shut up, Kim, and do what I say.
Right. But, I don't know, things are pretty bad now. Our contact with Starfleet, the thing that's been giving us this relief since Message in a Bottle, is this network. And it just went down. Like, problems. Now, granted, this isn't irreparable, per se. I mean, we don't really know if it is or not, but it seems like something that would be able to be fixed by a bunch of Starfleet scientists and engineers, but it's down, and I think they could have played that message, that moment up just a little bit more. Like, all hope that we just had is gone again.
Yeah, we do. I mean, fast forward to the future. I mean, all the fans will know we get back in contact. This is just the way to. This is the Voyager thing, though, right, guys? I mean, it's. I don't want to say it, but it's a bit of the reset button. You know, right. It's like, oh, we could get home. Oh, we could get in contact, yet it's taken away from us.
I want
it's
to say
a carrot and a stick.
It's a reset button as it is just a reminder that, oh yeah, we're still several thousand light years away. Like, we're still in a bad situation.
Yeah.
And the reason I wouldn't call it a reset button too, Ben, is what we talked about at the end of Message in a Bottle. Something was accomplished from this. In so many of these episodes, nothing's accomplished. We're back at square one. We didn't do anything. This time, they actually got contact, be it ever so brief, but they took that first step forward. So,
I know, but when they blew up the relay station, I went, that figures. It's all coming.
Well, it's still Voyager, after all.
It is.
What they do here,
can't get away from it. Yep.
After all this action and stuff, they're going to end the episode on some character moments, because Torres arrives on the bridge, and finally, we have a letter for Harry Kim, and he couldn't be happier. Of course, the letter for Tom wasn't able to be downloaded. I don't really understand, because Tom's letter was already coming in before we ever knew we had a letter for Harry. Oh, well, she says that he should assume that his father said that he loves and is proud of Tom. And Tom just takes it, probably because he doesn't want to anger B'Elanna again. But Tuvok and Seven were unharmed, and Tuvok goes in and has a meeting with Janeway. The Hirogen might be a little upset that their network's down now, so we need to kind of watch out for that.
Ben, you want to have this debate that you've been building up the whole episode now as to the plot hole with the Hirogen, please?
Thank you. So why does Harry Kim know that's a Hirogen ship?
Okay, it's definitely a plot hole. The only way I could get around it, and I don't want to turn this into a big debate because I'm more with you than not, Ben, that last week when they started getting the signals from the relay stations, I don't know if the Hirogen modified them at all or took possession of them.
Went back and looked. I went back and did my research. No mention.
Yeah, I know, but they do know the name Hirogen because of the communication they had last week.
We know the Hirogen.
Yeah, this relay station belongs to the Hirogen. So I don't know if they had like an energy signature that matched that in something that's in the relay stations, and that's how he knew it was Hirogen. It's a plot hole, but that's how I wrote it off.
I just feel it's a little out of place.
I just usually Voyager will give us that techno like stuff where, oh, the energy signal matches out of the blah 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 blah. You know, I as silly as that is, I actually really want them to say that. I just do.
Yeah,
I know. It's better. It's
the techno babble.
It's better if it's better if it's said, but that's how I interpreted it. In case
no, you're right. It's just it's Harry Kim giving the line, so I was figuring he must have either been the future Harry that we've seen before, or some other temporal transport. I don't know. Whatever.
Maybe there's a couple Harrys walking around the ship, and we just don't know it.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, the guy's been dead like five or six times and beamed through space. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, after the meeting between Tuvok and Janeway, Chakotay just walks on into the ready room again. Does nobody ring the doorbell in the ready room anymore? Anyway, he's saying that overall the ship's in pretty good shape, and he and Janeway decide to have some coffee.
Want some coffee?
You know, you drink too much of that stuff.
Really? If I'm not mistaken, that's your third cup this morning.
Fourth, and on a day like today, it won't be my last. Coffee. The finest organic suspension ever devised. It's got me through the worst of the last 3 years. I beat the Borg with it.
How are you doing?
Me? I'm fine.
You'd say that if you just had your legs torn off by a Traken beast. Look what you've been through the last few days. We finally make a connection with home, and then it's ripped away from us. We manage to make another enemy who's going to try and hunt us down and destroy us. And on top of that...
It's all right, you can say it. On top of all that, I got a Dear John letter. It wasn't really a surprise. I guess I didn't really expect him to wait for me, considering the circumstances. But it made me realize that I was using him as a safety net, you know, as a way to avoid becoming involved with someone else.
You don't have that safety net anymore.
That's right. Then again, my life is far from uneventful here in the Delta Quadrant. It's not like I would have had a chance to pursue a relationship, even if I had realized I was alone.
You're hardly alone. And to my way of thinking, there's still plenty of time.
Plenty of time.
Neelix to the ready room. The party's about to begin, and there are only two people missing.
We're on our way.
And they walk off arm in arm. Okay, yeah, come on.
I'm just...
We talked just a little bit ago about their professional relationship, and now he's all, how you doing? You know, you got we're all alone out here, you know.
Yeah, don't you like how he brought up, like, well, now that safety net's gone, and you can have a relationship if you want.
Who knows?
You're vulnerable out here. You're a woman. You need a man to take care of you.
Let me escort you to the party.
By the way,
you guys are all just jealous.
No.
Oh, really?
Ew. That's a terrible relationship. Who would want to be in it? But anyway, I'm just saying, like, Gino, good call on not ringing the freaking doorbell, too, either.
Seriously. I mean, it started with Seven. Like, what, was it last episode? No, it was a few episodes ago when she just
But Seven, it's understandable.
Yeah, but she doesn't know better.
The other thing, too, is, like, the only way that scene could have been made, well, it would have undercut the drama of the scene, but she says, I got a Dear John letter. Technically, she got a Dear Jane letter, or a Dear Janeway letter, if you will.
Seriously. Dear Catherine, come on.
Well, but, I just got to say, usually I like Voyager's endings. This one, no thank you. No thank you. It left a sour taste in my mouth. It really did.
We should not have had the Chakotay scene at all. We didn't need it. It was way too much character-driven exposition at the very end of the episode.
I will say I like what the scene does for Janeway, but it sets something up that I just don't want to see, and thank God we never did see.
The image in my head I have right now is when Janeway was in the tub with Q, except I'm not seeing Q, I am seeing Robert Beltran.
Well, he did make her a bathtub, didn't he?
Oh God.
Yes, he did.
More bubbles, Chakotay.
I liked it, guys. Sorry.
All righty. 4-1.
That's it. The end.
And I'm not going back in the damn brig either.
you don't get any say in that, do you?
No, you don't.
Well, that wraps up Hunters, guys. And, well, that was certainly an interesting discussion. But we're going to move on to final thoughts and ratings. So, Blair, what are your final thoughts on this episode, Hunters, and what would you give it out of 5 stars?
Well, I like episodes, as we mentioned, that set the foundation for things to come. And I think, as we mentioned often throughout this episode, this definitely... sets up the puts a good foundation in place, and I also like too. There was a lot of good character moments, as well as a lot of the people had to face the harsh reality that life went on without them back in the Alpha Quadrant. I like the as I mentioned, the Letters from Home storyline could have been its own episode. There was a lot to jam pack in it. In one episode, but it was still really, really good. The one thing, I thought the Hirogen were amazing, great introduction. The only one thing I would have liked to have seen from them is a little more viciousness. Similar to, for those people that read the Destiny books, they were pretty vicious in that. I know it's a TV episode, but I would have liked to have seen them, be a little more vicious in, taking out Tuvok or whatnot. But overall, it was a great episode, and I would rate this a 4.0.
Nice high rating there. Gino, what about you?
Okay, I am going to echo a lot of the things that Blair said. I would agree with you that making the focus of the letters be an episode in itself, because it was the A plot of the episode, definitely, but I think that would be more of a TNG focus, and Voyager's really trying to make a name for itself here. I mean, it's got a solid base. We're in season 4, so we're trying to make something that's different, but still kind of going off of that. On that, I think the Hirogen didn't give a big enough part. If they want us to be afraid of these guys, they need to be a bigger focus, and I don't think that they did enough of that. They're trying to go off of the rolling ball that we have going for Message in a Bottle, which had three cohesive storylines that all meshed really well together. These two were a definite plot one and plot two, and while running right alongside each other, were completely different. So they could have been their own episodes and probably would have done very well with a singular plot episode. That being said, it was enjoyable. I would give our conversation about it a 5, definitely, but because we just held it up against the magnificence, the glory that was Message in a Bottle, I'm giving this a 4.
All right, what about you, Melissa?
I love this episode very, very much. Like I said at the beginning, I thought this was, it felt a lot like a Deep Space Nine episode. There was so much character stuff going on, and not just character development, but it was like every character on the show had their own plot line. And I loved seeing that. I loved seeing everything that they packed into it. I cared more about every one of those people at the end of the show than I did when the show started. And I think that's got to be the goal of good writing. Loved the show. I could really take or leave the Hirogen stuff, I guess. It just wasn't really what I was interested in watching this show. And maybe that points to the fact that there should have been more of that in the show. I'm not sure. But again, I just really love this episode. I loved what they did with all the characters. I loved all of this history coming back to haunt them and everyone having to deal with it. I'm going to give this 4.5 stars.
Ben, we move on to you next.
All right. So as a big-time lover of episodic television, I do love my daily bad guys. And I think the Hirogen, seeing them for the second time, I mean, we saw a Message in a Bottle. They were imposing a little bit for what they got. Here, though, it just builds on that. It is back-to-back. So we see the same bad guys twice in a row. And to me, that would have been enough. Most of you said it's all about the characters. And I think that is the majority of the episode. That's the heart of the episode. But what pushes it over the top for me is wanting to see these new aliens, this new ship, these new bad guys. So I'm glad that they at least paid attention to them. I think if it would have been all character moments, I would have got one too many Chakotay Janeways, and it would have really suffered. So I think the Hirogen definitely are a major bonus. I'm looking ahead in the future. I know where we go, so I know there's payoff. So I have, no ill feelings about them introducing such a cool alien race to us at this moment in time and not giving us too much explanation. So I think I'll just give it a 4. I think that's a solid episode.
Just to echo Ben's point there, I mean, I do think the Hirogen, while they may have been a dissonant plot from what was mainly going on, it is a necessary plot. I mean, after all, they chose to call the episode Hunters. So for an episode called Hunters, we need to see some hunting going on. But, I do like this episode quite a bit. The thing is that, Ben, I know you're not terribly, terribly crazy about character development and all that sort of stuff, but my whole thesis that I said at the beginning of this episode was it would have been false for the issues that are presented here in this episode to never be addressed. And it's one of those things that Voyager could have easily skipped because it's never really delved that deep before. I think that they're willing to take some more chances now. They're willing to dig deeper into these characters and realize that, to what Melissa said, these people, unlike the rest of the crew we've had in every Star Trek before, they had lives before this series began, and they had to leave those lives behind. So it only makes sense that we see those past lives come back to either haunt them or, you know, get some closure from them. And aside from the Chakotay Janeway thing, which I'm so glad was never followed through on, the rest of it is just pretty incredible. And I really enjoyed it quite a bit. I think it does wonders for character development. I think the Hirogen are awesome. I can't wait to see what happens with them next. I mean, Ben, you said we get them twice in a row. We're going to get them three times in a row next week when we get to that episode. But until then, this was a pretty solid effort, so I'm going to give it 4.25.
So wait, we're not going to see an exploration of Janeway Chakotay?
Not really.
Okay, good.
Gives you hope for the future, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think I just gave another star back to the show.
But I want to extend my thanks to Blair for coming back to talk Hunters with us. It was a lot of fun having you back on the show, and definitely I want to have you on again in the future.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'd love to come back on again, and it was a lot of fun, and it's great to be on now for two good episodes.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of fun to have you here,
and I'm sure I can speak for everybody when I say we really appreciate your feedback on the forums. You always have some very good insights.
Thanks.
You keep us rocking and rolling, by the way.
And you're one of the people that always leaves feedback, too, which is...
That's true. And to quote the Terminator, Matt, he will be back.
Thanks. No, it was great.
To paraphrase the Terminator, you mean.
Hey.
Well, until then, we're going to say hasta la vista, baby. And this is Matt. This is Matt in Arizona closing Hailing Frequencies.
This is Ben Arizona saying goodnight.
This is Melissa from North Dakota saying Chakotay really wasn't so bad in this episode.
Get to the brig. This is Gino in Oklahoma saying get to the chopper.
And this is Blair from Ontario, Canada. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to the Delta Quadrant. Please join us again next week. Star Trek Voyager and the Voyager theme song are the property of CBS Television Studios, and no infringement is intended.
You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.